Alice Kaplan is our guest this evening. She is the author of The Collaborator, The Trial and Execution of Robert Brazier. This book, which was published by the University of Chicago Press, was across this past year nominated for the National Book Award, as well as the National Book Critics Circle Award. And there are other awards for which it has been shortlisted. It's a work of great talent. She herself is the daughter of one of the American prosecutors at the Nuremberg trials. And I think that, in a way, sort of shaped some of her views on being interested in issues surrounding the dark side of World War II. It was also something that I think came along with the time that she came to maturity in her intellectual life. It was a time in the early 70s when we as a culture were beginning to look at the dark side of government, per se, in America, and the time surrounding Vietnam. Her educational experience at Berkeley in that time period only, of course, heightened that awareness. But it was something then she carried into her examination of French culture, looking at not the sweetness and light of it, but the obverse, the flip side of the coin that is also part of the whole. In The Collaborator, Alice Kaplan recounts the life and work and death of Brassiac. He was a French citizen who had gained fame as a novelist, poet, and playwright. In 1938, he was called up for military service and became a prisoner of war after Germany invaded France. Virulently anti-Semitic, he disclosed Jewish fellow prisoners to his Nazi prison guards. His reward was an early release. A free man, Brazier became an open Third Reich supporter, using his talents as a writer to produce tracts castigating and condemning European Jewry. And with the liberation, in 1944, Brassiac became one of the thousands of suspected collaborators collared by the resistance government. His trial, and this I quote from Richard Corliss in Time Review of The Collaborator, his trial, as recreated by Kaplan, is suffused with the drama and heft of Dreyfus's or Joan of Arc's. Convicted of intelligence with the enemy, a phrase that translates out of French. Brassiac was sentenced to death by firing squad, a war crime execution based on the written word. Kaplan's work in The Collaborator reveals that Brassiac subjugated his various kinds of diffuse passions, including homoerotic fascination with Aryans and the Hitler mentality, into his sense as a collaborator. She maintained that though guilty of treason, that Brassiac should not have been executed, quote, at least in part because it made him a martyr to Holocaust deniers, which indeed has happened. But this is a book that has just a remarkable depth and breadth. As a nonfiction work, it has all the drama of fiction. It has the anticipation and a resolution as we explore everything through the trial. It has a great backdrop given for an American audience, but as just another note of credit to it, is about to be published in France, and as something I think that will give a French audience a deeper understanding into itself. It has been described as a rare scholarly page-turner, and it brilliantly demonstrates how a trial can affect the lives of a citizenry, a whole country, and a worldview. Kaplan is also a professor at Duke University, where she is director of the Center for French and Francophone Studies. It is a pleasure and a delight to have her with us tonight. Please welcome Alice Kaplan.
Thank you, Don. It's a pleasure to be here with you, and thanks for inviting me to speak about The Collaborator. The Collaborator is about a man named Robert Braziak, the only really respectable writer who went to his death during the post-war purge of collaborators in France. He was a talented, prolific writer and a passionate ideologue, editor of the major fascist and anti-Semitic newspaper in Paris called Je Suis Partout. And he was executed by firing squad in 1945 for collaborationist treason with the Nazis. He died at age 35, leaving behind volumes of his writing and a reactionary political legacy that is part of the story I'm telling. Among all the collaborators who were tried and punished in the liberation era, and there were some 50,000 French men and women tried, Braziak was unique because he was executed for his words, fighting words. If you look at a photo of him, there's a photo of him on the cover of my book, you can see that he's a bookish type, nothing like the stereotype of a fascist thug. What drew me to this book was just that, trying to figure out how this writer went wrong, how his talent for words got him into so much trouble. Braziak was a pugnacious critic, the golden boy of the right-wing cultural pundits of the 1930s, a powerful newspaper editor and critic who could already make or break reputations when he was barely 30 years old. When France was taken over by the Nazis, he used his wit to attack the French Republic and endorse the collaborators. He wrote that the French Republic that had been defeated in 1940 was, quote, an old syphilitic whore, stinking of patchouli and yeast infection, still exhaling her bad odors, still standing on the sidewalk. Later, he echoed the prime minister in official Vichy policy that resulted in the deportation of 76,000 Jews from France. He wrote, quote, we have to separate from the Jews en bloc and not keep any little ones. He later claimed this was a humanitarian sentiment, that he wanted Jewish parents and children to be able to stay together. He denounced the leaders who had governed France before her fall. He denounced Gaullists, supporters of General de Gaulle's Free French in London. He denounced Jews, resistance fighters, calling them terrorists and calling for their death. Under his editorship, his newspaper printed the names and addresses of people in hiding. When Braziak came to trial in 1945, he was not judged for being a fascist or for being an anti-Semite. He went on trial for treason, what the French call intelligence with the enemy. The prosecution would try to prove that he was a traitor, an outsider to the values of the nation. The defense would try to show that he was, on the contrary, a great writer who honored France. The trial itself was a highly theatrical event that lasted only 6 hours. You can imagine working on this book during the OJ trial. Those 6 hours seemed awfully short to me. The room was packed in the trial with students, intellectuals, journalists. Simone de Beauvoir was there, and Merleau-Ponty. Not only was one man's life at stake in this trial, so was the future of a nation, its sense of its own history, the way it understood the power of the written word. Everyone in the courtroom knows how much is at stake and acts accordingly. I should add that the arguments in this trial about what collaboration is, what resistance is, who was to blame for France's fate, are still going on. In France today, Braziak is a martyr for the extreme right, a politically charged figure. His brother-in-law, Maurice Bardèche, who died in 1998, was a mentor to Holocaust revisionists, as well as the guardian of Braziak's literary legacy. Readers of my memoir, French Lessons, may remember the chapter where I describe interviewing him. But even among those who detest everything Braziak stood for, His case is still an occasion for debate, and his conviction and execution remain an ethical and moral dilemma. This dilemma has been heightened by the recent crimes against humanity trials of Vichy bureaucrats involved in the deportation of 76,000 Jews from France. Why was a writer killed when others with more direct responsibility for the deportations went free? Tonight I'm going to read from the chapter called Court that narrates the trial itself. Here are the four principal players. There's Vidal, the presiding judge, Reboul, the prosecutor, Izorni, the defense lawyer, and Brasillach, who stands throughout in a wood-paneled docket that the French call the box of the accused. In addition, there are four jurors from the working-class suburbs of Paris, chosen for their credentials in the resistance. The passage I'm going to read is especially tricky because Brasillach comes off well. I've chosen this passage because it shows one of the major challenges I faced writing The Collaborator, how to show the complexities of a man who does great harm, but who has talent, wit, and some attractive qualities. The interrogation, 1:45 p.m. The interrogation marked the opening of the trial itself. It was the heart of the event, the moment Brasillach had prepared for in his cell for hours. It was his time to speak and to shine. He couldn't let his attention wander, for his performance was all he had to convince the jury in his favor. Judge Vidal's job was to surface information gathered by the examining magistrate and bring all the accusations clearly to light, preparing the grounds for Reboul, the state prosecutor, who would follow up the interrogation with a speech demanding a guilty verdict. Vidal's role was not a flashy one, nor would he have been capable of flash. His charge was more scholarly and substantive than Reboul's, which suited his dutiful, deferential personality. Nonetheless, the pressure on him was intense. His task was double. He needed to prevent Brasillach from shining too much, and he needed to indicate at every step at which his quick-witted adversary had willingly betrayed France. Vidal was a good man, a solid magistrate, and he was about to fail. It was a long and almost unbearably polite exchange. Vidal asked Brasillach to rise. The accused stood at the edge of his box, holding the railing with both hands. Vidal was gray and dignified behind his table. The jurors sat upright. As Brasillach positioned himself for the interrogation, the press corps scanned him carefully, looking for just the right physical detail to capture a 35-year-old writer on trial for his life. Short fingers, noted Francine Bonitzer. Tiny little hands barely sticking out from his sleeves, wrote Elze, the elder statesman from Le Figaro. Vidal launched his gambit. You have a polemicist temperament, a violent temperament besides. You did your first jousting at the newspaper L'Intransigeant?
I worked at L'Intransigeant for 1 month.
A point for Brasillach. He had already caught the court in an exaggeration, practically a mistake. Vidal tried to recover. And it seems that this paper did not have a political flavor well adapted to your temperament. Brasillach's response was modest and measured. There are in the indictment a certain number of small errors of detail that are otherwise quite unimportant. It reports my collaboration at L'Intransigeant, which was completely ephemeral. It says that I worked at a newspaper called L'Insurgé, which is inexact. I never worked there. It says that I worked for the paper Le Jour, to which I contributed nothing but a single article on tourism. It says that my pen name was Midas, which is false, since that is the name of the gossip columnist at Je Suis Partout, which I have never been. These are insignificant errors, but I prefer to rectify them in advance so as not to have to speak of them again. Braziak corrected the errors in the indictment with the most extreme care and politeness, with a disinterestedness, like a good historian wanting to set the record straight. Beneath the perfect diction of the student from the prestigious École Normale, you could hear the shadow of an accent, the sing-song of the south of France. More important, Braziak's tone was gentle. That tone in itself belied the charge of violent temperament in Vidal's opening. Vidal could only thank him. You are right to rectify errors that might have slipped into the indictment, but in any case, you did work for a month at L'Intransigeant, and you next took your pen to the Action Française. What a shock for Vidal to have prepared to interrogate the famously rude Braziak and find instead a meticulously kind and gentle respondent. Braziak's pose not only surprised Vidal, it intimidated him. From that first moment on, his interrogation lacked direction and focus. He broached Braziak's editorship of Je Suis Partout next, but he jumped forward to the writer's break with the paper in 1943. He was starting at the end of Braziak's career instead of the beginning. Braziak, standing in his box, quickly sized up his adversary. Very nondescript, but impartial, to be fair. He was encouraged in his strategy, which was to push him out of the way and insert the longest possible speech. On the subject of his break with Je Suis Partout, Braziak took control of the floor for nearly 15 minutes. Beneath him, on the defense bench, his lawyer was optimistic. So far, their plan was working far better than he had expected. On his departure from Je Suis Partout, Braziak argued that he had sacrificed economic gains out of high patriotic principle. He had left the newspaper at the height of its financial success when he thought the fascist cause was lost. Vidal managed to interject a brief word, suggesting it wasn't principle, but opportunism, since Braziak knew in 1943 that his side was going to lose. In his own defense, Braziak quoted well-chosen passages of a private letter he had sent to his colleague Rebatté at the time of his break. The letter had been seized at Rebatté's apartment for state's evidence. He had written to Rebatté, "I am French more than National Socialist, and in case of danger, one must stick with the nation. Only she does not betray." It was a clever use of prose that was supposed to count against him. When Vidal accused Braziak of calling the Gaullists traitors, Braziak responded evenly, "Today I do not blame those who chose to fight for their country against their native soil, but I ask that it be recognized that those who chose their native soil back then were acting in the direct line of a certain French tradition." "But we are all very happy today that there existed those whom you called Gaullist traitors, for I don't know otherwise where we would be today," Vidal countered. "That is a question we can treat in a minute with respect to the articles," Braziak replied. It was an astonishing retort. Braziak was not only holding the floor, he was presuming to guide the direction of the debate. This was not a reassuring moment for Prosecutor Raboul. "What about your links to Nazi propaganda outfits?" Vidal asked next. "What about the Rive Gauche bookstore where you served on the board?" That luxurious bookstore had beautiful window displays, reading rooms, meeting space, and space for exhibits, pro-Nazi exhibits. In 1941, you could have just seen a display there lauding the opportunity to do work service for the Reich. "Mr. President," Braziak responded, "there is a profound error here for an extremely simple reason, which is that I do not see how a bookstore that sells essentially French books, since they sold 10 French books for every 6 German books." As the charges mounted up against him, Brasiak sustained his polite tone, his lack of defensiveness. Alexandre Astruc, writing for Combat, admired what he saw as Brasiak's unflinching pride, his dignity, while Madeleine Jacob, more suspicious, saw a touch of insolence in his serenity. But everyone was struck by his astonishing control.
We reproach you with having sat on a German board of directors. You don't deny it. We reproach you, said Vidal.
It was another one of those empty accusations that allowed Brasiak to insert a speech, a good 5 minutes long this time, giving the history of the Rive Gauche bookstore and its mission to furnish German troops with reading material, to encourage translations and Franco-German intellectual exchange. Brasiak leaned toward the tribunal, letting his glasses slide down his nose. The bookstore was most concerned with selling the French classics in beautiful leather-bound Pléiade editions to libraries in German towns and universities that had been bombed by the Allies. We sold an incalculable number of works by Molière, Saint-Simon, Corneille, Racine. We sold, in particular, collections of Pléiade editions in great quantity to be sent to reconstitute French collections that were missing in German universities. The writer was on home turf here, arguing about the value of literature. Yet even his most literary defense gives a sharp insight into his politics. For most Parisians, the Rive Gauche bookstore had represented collaboration, fascism, and the presence of German soldiers on the streets of Paris. For Brasiak, the only tragedy was that German cities were being bombed by the Allies and that German citizens were being deprived of great French literature. Vidal made another leap in his questioning from Brasiak's support of the bookstore to Brasiak's love for Germany in general. He referred to one of Brasiak's articles from 1943, La naissance d'un sentiment, the birth of a feeling.
You proclaimed your love, and these are your terms, quote, your love for the soldiers of the Felngrau. You want to, quote, shake their hands for no particular reason, as if they were our own boys.
Vidal was finally advancing on the terrain where he believed Brasiak was most vulnerable. But he had put his foot in his mouth again. The prosecutor, Raboul, alert to the faux pas, rose immediately, hoping to save his colleague from embarrassment.
Mr. President, if you allow me, the first phrase was taken from Brasiak's interview with the examining magistrate, Mr. Raoul. Love for the Feldgrau, this is the exact term you used, does not appear in the article. Many other things, alas, do appear, but I have to say that, in truth, the words love for the Feldgrau do not figure there and were not used.
Vidal should have moved on immediately, but he insisted on his own mistake. You didn't write those lines? Brasiak responded charitably. I believe there is an error, not a typo, but a slip of the pen. They put quotation marks in the wrong place, and your love for the Feldgrau is Mr. Raoul's phrase. Vidal could only add,
you did say that Germans were friends of the same race.
Brasiak reassured him. On the other hand, that phrase is mine.
I won't quibble with you about the word Feldgrau. It is in the same spirit, said Vidal.
But he had just quibbled and wasted more precious time. Brasiak gathered strength from the judge's error, and he took the floor at length again, beginning with a scholarly explanation of the phrase, friends of the same race, and verging into a defense of the Germans as a necessary protection against the communists. As far as German atrocities went, he claimed the French colonial atrocities in Indochina, circa 1930, were much worse. It was a rhetorical victory. He had managed to change the subject completely from German crimes in France to French crimes in the colonies. Vidal continued for another hour. He tried to weaken Brasiak's claim that he was a Vichy patriot, not a Nazi traitor. He began to quote from Brasiak's journalism, attacks against the Third Republic ministers, romantic references to fascism and Nazism, attacks on the Gaullist traitors, Braziac's repeated desire for a quick and prompt justice, a, quote, repression without pity against his political enemies, who were also the enemies of Nazism, of the Nazis, excuse me. It is where he should have started, with the idea that Braziac's attacks served the enemy. These written attacks, not the Rive Gauche bookstore, not the German Institute, not the trips to Germany, were the basis of the treason charge. By now, Braziac had been standing for 2 hours. He was still leaning against the rail of his box, his hands clasped together politely, very much the professor at his lectern. A thick strand of black hair had fallen on his brow. He responded, "What makes you think that the Germans ordered me to say what I said? They could care less what I said." "The instant you understood that your writing served the Germans, you should have abstained from making those attacks," was Vidal's moralistic reply. "I believe that my writing served my country above all," countered Braziac. And he launched into a series of declarations, patiently outlining his attitudes one by one, toward the Republic, which he saw as responsible for the defeat, toward the Gaullists, whom he considered illegitimate, towards the internal resistance, which he considered contaminated by bandits and foreigners, towards the communists, whom he considered a danger for France. His anti-Semitism in particular, he said, was in place long before the war broke out, and it was part of a deeply French tradition, practiced by eminent writers such as Giraudoux and the Tarot brothers. On the issue of tradition alone, no one could deny that there was more than a grain of truth in Braziac's claim. Anti-Semitism had been a powerful strain in French thought, at least since the Dreyfus affair. With his focus clearly on defending himself against the treason charge, Braziac insisted that his collaboration had been in the best interests of France. When confronted with the denunciatory language he used towards his own countrymen, Braziac replied that his beliefs were French beliefs. His fascism was a French nationalist fascism. His anti-Semitism belonged to a French, not a German tradition. In that way, he hoped to refocus the debate on his French identity rather than on the content of his beliefs. Now, all through the interrogation, Braziac insisted that he took full responsibility for his actions, and he used the word responsibility 6 times. I think his marshaling of this one word is really the key to his success here. Braziac ended his interrogation by describing how he refused to go to Germany at the liberation and had gone into hiding instead. He refused to escape. As he told the story, what happened next was a hostage situation in his own family. "I discovered that my whole family had been arrested, my brother-in-law, my stepfather, my mother herself. When I learned that they had arrested my mother, I decided not to wait any longer and to turn myself in. My mother was arrested in the provinces. She stayed for 3 weeks in a filthy prison, 30 persons to a 3-by-4-meter cell with 4 straw mats for the 30. As soon as the letter arrived in Sens, that's Braziac's hometown, announcing that I had turned myself in as a prisoner, she was liberated immediately." Braziac wanted the court to know that he had accepted responsibility where it most counted, in the bosom of his family. He glanced at the jurors sitting dutifully at Judge Vidal's side. It was their right to ask questions during the interrogation, but they had remained silent. He thought they looked wooden. Unbeknownst to him, one of those blank-looking jurors, the big man with a mustache and the wind-burned face named André van der Becken, was horrified to learn that Braziac's mother had been used as bait for his arrest. Each time he raised the issue of responsibility, Braziac attempted to move the discussion from an ideological representation of two opposing sides, collaboration and resistance, one wrong and one right, to a larger, non-ideological moral vision where a good man could take responsibility on either side, be a hero either of the collaboration or the resistance by sticking to his guns. A good man could be either a collaborator or a resistor, depending on his strength of character. It was the first time since the Court of Justice trials began in October that a collaborator had refused to apologize. Braziak looked out at the crowded courtroom and in his cool tenor capped the entire interrogation with a memorable final phrase, "I can regret nothing of what I have been." Thank you.